From Vermont to Kentucky, South Dakota to Mississippi, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Donald Trump continues to hold a large lead in the race for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. But has his support peaked? Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies is here with the polling numbers. A new federal budget is due October 1st, but once again, don't expect Congress to get the job done anywhere near on time. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has a real story. A town without zoning? It seems to work for one New York community, but that could be changing. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine have details. And implementation of the proposed global corporate minimum tax has been delayed. The United States should make the delay permanent. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. With the first 2024 Republican presidential debate, and likely more indictments of Donald Trump looming, the former president continues to hold a commanding lead for his party's nomination. But has his support hit a peak? Keith Naughton is principal at Silent Majority Strategies, and he writes for The Hill and other publications. He joins us now for a look at the latest polling numbers. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, Donald Trump continues to lead the Republican primary, particularly in the national polls, by a very large margin. Have we hit peak Trump yet?
Well, I think we may have, and we may be a little bit past it. His polling average in Real Clear Politics for the Republican nomination actually peaked about the end of May, where he averaged about 56%. And since then, he slid down to about 52% or thereabouts. He just had two pretty good polls come out for him, one from Morning Consult and one from YouGov. And Morning Consult's kind of a Trump-friendly poll. They've always polled pretty high for him. So he's already gone down a little bit. You know, he's still well ahead of the field, clearly. One of the curious things and the most difficult things that we have in figuring out what's going on in the Republican nomination is that the polling companies aren't doing what I would call legitimate polls. They're not going into the field and getting entirely new samples there. They're having like a group of maybe 1,000 people, and they talk to 500 of them every month. And so they're kind of washing and repeating the wash cycle on these samples. That's not a great way to poll because you end up in this sort of band. So you have Morning Consult has Trump consistently in the upper 50s, and Fox News has him in the mid 50s, and then Reuters has him in the upper 40s. When, if the polls were accurate, they would kind of wobble around each other. So we don't know exactly where Trump is. We do know consistently in these polls that he's fell down a little bit. We also know that his favorable, unfavorable has also been going down. Right after the Bragg indictment, he was at a 42-53 deficit. Now he's down to a 39-57 deficit. So these indictments are not helping. People say that he gets stronger with each charge. That is just not true. It's not proven by the numbers.
As the race started to unfold here, Keith, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who in most polls is consistently a second-place finisher, way behind Trump, but usually pretty far ahead of the other contenders, although we're starting to see some movement there as well. What is it with the Ron DeSantis campaign that it came out of the gate with a lot of high hopes, a lot of energy, but then didn't quite seem to go anywhere? What happened?
Well, I think there's a couple things. First off, you know, it turns out the idea of Ron DeSantis seems to have been better than the reality of Ron DeSantis. And that's just the nature of politics sometimes. I think that, you know, he's a rookie. He hasn't done this before. And there's something to be said about having some experience on the national stage. Trump was also a rookie to national politics in a way, but he'd been in the news and in the media for decades, especially the New York media, which is such a meat grinder. So he really had that facility, and still it shows that he's got a great facility with the media. And Governor DeSantis and others, they just don't have that experience. So it's a huge advantage for Trump. I think DeSantis had a great record and great message, but he's spreading himself thin. He's trying to run a national primary. We don't vote nationally. We vote state by state. So I think that's a mistake. And I think he's really got to focus on two or three basic things and keep hammering them home. Trump consumes the news cycle so completely because he gets clicks, and we know that the media is mostly about entertainment and ratings and getting clicks, so he just dominates it. DeSantis can break through with a consistent message repeatedly, but, you know, he's not doing that. I think that's inexperience, and I think that's, you know, maybe a little bit of panic about how his numbers have fallen, because they have fallen significantly. Although he's still clearly in second place in the Republican.
There are some others starting to bubble up a bit, one of whom is Tim Scott, who seems to be impressing a lot of folks here, Keith, particularly with a more positive message. What do you see happening with him? Does he have any sort of a pathway here?
Well, Tim Scott has lowest unfavorables amongst Republicans of anyone in the field. But in sports, nice guys finish last. In politics, they may not finish last, but they rarely win. So I think Scott's got that problem in that people like him, but they haven't indicated they're going to vote for him. So his national numbers have ticked up very slightly. He's still under 5%. He's doing a little bit better in Iowa and New Hampshire, where I think he's concentrating. But he's actually been passed by Ramaswamy on the national level. I think that Scott is in a position where if the former president's legal troubles become so overwhelming that he leaves the race, and that is still a possibility, that Scott's in a position to maybe get into that vacuum and maybe collect support from Trump voters who have been turned against DeSantis by Trump's attacks, or who aren't ready to support a complete newcomer like Ramaswamy. So that's really what Tim Scott needs. He needs Trump to leave and try to collect those votes. I think he's pretty much everyone's second, maybe third choice, which is better than most candidates.
We have coming up here in just a couple of weeks, Keith, the first Republican presidential debate. Do you see that as an opportunity for one or more of these candidates to have a breakthrough moment?
I think it is. I think it's a chance for them to introduce themselves to a larger audience. I think that there is a lot of risk there because they're going to have to go on the record about Trump's indictments. And being supportive of Trump is good with the Republican primary crowd, but it's not good for a general election. So that could be a challenge if they need to go on the record. They'd be better off sticking with the issues, but I don't think you can avoid Trump's trouble. One of the problems I think that they face is I would bet that Donald Trump's going to run a rally or do some event concurrent with that debate and just blow the debate out of the water and just kind of humiliate everyone with his own media power. I mean, he's really not going to cut anybody else a break. And there's a slim possibility that he just shows up at the last minute and tries to dominate the stage.
We will continue to keep an eye on the 2024 presidential election and all the polling related to it with Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. And Keith, tell us a little bit about Silent Majority Strategies. You also write a lot in The Hill and various other publications. So where can folks go to read your writings?
Well, I write regularly for The Messenger, which is a new news site. They do a great job in, I think, covering things on a straight news basis. And I still write for The Hill.
Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies, The Hill, The Messenger, many other publications as well. Keith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's keeping an eye primarily on Capitol Hill this week, where we've had a lot of action on a couple of fronts. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
First of all, let's talk about Mitch McConnell. A very scary situation earlier this week where he pretty much froze up at the podium. What can you tell us about that episode?
Well, Leader McConnell, every week that the Senate is in session, he leads the Republican press conference. You've got all the Republican leadership that's standing alongside him, from John Thune and John Barrasso, Joni Ernst, Steve Daines, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. All those folks are standing up there, and they basically give their updates on the week. But it starts out with Leader McConnell, and he began to talk about the National Defense Authorization Act this week. And then, you're right, he just sort of froze and stopped speaking, wasn't blinking. And for 19 seconds, he just sat there and stared. And so another senator came over and said, you know, Mitch, do you have anything else you want to say to the press? And they kind of ushered him off to the side. Eventually, he went back to his office, and they continued with the press conference. Senator Thune from South Dakota began his remarks to talk about the work of the Senate, and Thune is the minority whip. So a few minutes later, McConnell did return, and he told reporters, I'm fine, nothing to see here, I'm okay. But there's a lot of folks that remember he had a pretty nasty fall earlier in the spring that kept him out of the Senate for 6 weeks. We also have had persistent health issues with John Fetterman from your Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and we've had persistent and pretty terrible health situation with Dianne Feinstein from California. We know that the Senate is full of aging politicians that have been in office really their entire lives. And so there's a lot of questions about how long Mitch McConnell can remain as the leader of the Republican Senate. Last year during the leadership elections, there were about a dozen Republican senators that opposed McConnell and supported Rick Scott from Florida. It was basically a show vote. They knew that McConnell was going to be elected leader again, but it was demonstrative of basically a desire from some senators to have new leadership in the United States Senate. McConnell has continued to persevere. He's continued to lead the Senate, but I think that the episode this week, front and center in front of the Washington Press Corps in the Senate, is another example that it's time for new conservative leaders to come to Washington and really usher in a new era of new ideas.
And one of the main tasks of Congress, of course, is to pass a budget, which is supposed to be done by October 1st. It hasn't happened in, well, decades. The process is getting underway, is underway. What sort of action has taken place this week, and are we going to get it done on time this year?
Well, I'll say no. I try to be optimistic, though, and give the House credit for what they're doing. Speaker McCarthy engaged in this negotiation over the debt limit with Joe Biden, and he basically went back on previous negotiations with the House Freedom Caucus conservatives over what the spending levels were going to be for this year. And when he went back on those, they had a real problem going forward with the appropriations bills. So there's been prolonged negotiations with the House conservatives and Leader McCarthy to try to get these bills through the House of Representatives and maybe get some of them passed through the United States Senate. Well, tell me if you've heard this before, but I don't think that the Senate is going to pass any appropriation bills that are able to pass the House of Representatives and be signed into law by President Biden. And what that means is that in September, as we end the fiscal year on September 30th, that we're going to pass what's known as another one of these continuing resolutions. And basically, those appropriation bills continue spending at current levels with current policies for however long the bill lasts. So sometimes they do a CR for 6 weeks. Sometimes they do it for 6 days. Sometimes they do it for 6 months. Well, I would predict on or around September 30th that they will pass another appropriation CR that extends spending into mid-December, right before the Christmas holidays. You and I have discussed this for 4.5 straight years, how the broken process in appropriations is leading to out-of-control spending and irresponsibility. When I look at appropriations, I think that it's pretty simple, right? You basically should spend what you're bringing in. We're bringing in record levels of revenue. We're taxing the American people way too much. And I would support steep tax cuts. But what instead we have is still this persistence on bankrupting America through additional federal spending and leading to trillion-dollar deficits. Right now, the debt limit is suspended through January 2025, meaning Joe Biden and the uniparty in Washington gets to spend as much as they want, unlimited fashion, without any real accountability on in terms of fiscal strings that would be attached. So what I think will happen is some of these show votes, obviously what the House is doing is as much as they can do to get the process started. They're working in good faith, but I don't have any real certainty or belief that the United States Senate is actually going to pass appropriation bills that get signed into law by Joe Biden until we do what will be a split omnibus in December. I will predict that there will be a security bus and a non-security bus. One big bill to handle all the defense appropriations and homeland security and things like that, and then the other one to handle most of the domestic priorities that we have in Washington, D.C.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org. Sign up and become a member for free.
Thank you, Scott. We'll check in with you next week.
Thank you, Loman.
Zoning ordinances are found in just about every municipality, but one small town in New York has so far avoided such rules, as we learn from Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine.
There aren't a lot of places in America where you could own land and not be subject to some sort of zoning code, not be subject to the government telling you what you can and can't do with that land that you own. And there might soon be one fewer place on the map where you can avoid that. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is my Reason colleague, Christian Britschke. He's the author of a feature piece you can find in the latest edition of the magazine, The Town Without Zoning. Christian, thanks for joining us again here on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating piece. You found this little hamlet, Caroline, New York. Tell us a little bit about this place, The Town Without Zoning.
Sure. So Caroline is a pretty small rural community just outside of Ithaca, New York. The town has existed since, I believe, 1801, and it's an incorporated town, but most inside its borders is mostly farmland, open space, and it's just been a small dairy town since basically the Revolution.
There's now a fight going on there, and it's been going on for, the better part of, 2 years over whether to create a zoning code for the town, basically to divide it up into, a commercial section, a residential section, et cetera.
Recently, the town has been experiencing, it's outside of Ithaca, as I mentioned, and so it's been experiencing some growth as folks from Ithaca, often associated with Cornell University, have moved into the town and who are, as a result, become worried that it will see rampant commercial development that'll ruin the open spaces that they moved out there for. And so people with those concerns have started pushing for, at first it was, they started pushing to stop a Dollar General moving to town, which is something that was very difficult for them to do because the town didn't have zoning, so they didn't have any explicit reason to say no to a Dollar General development. But so instead they passed just an overall temporary building moratorium back in 2020. And that then led the people worried about this kind of commercial sprawl, commercial development, to push for the adoption of a zoning code that allowed them to put more restrictions on the kind of growth that could happen in the town.
Yeah, I think it's a great story. And I think the way you kind of draw this out in the piece of it's these people coming in that want to preserve the way the town looks, which in some ways is maybe a noble goal. But then you've got people who have been there for a long time, the people who actually live in the town. You profile, people who own a wedding venue in the town. You profile some farmers. These are people who stand to lose some of the value of their land, potentially the farmers. And really jumped out to me because they were in the process of selling some of their land to a development. And now if there's a zoning code, they may not be able to do that.
Right. So this is a really interesting wrinkle with this story. It's what made it attractive to me to write about is it's mostly newcomers to the town who are looking to place restrictions on development to preserve the open space and the farmland. But many of these farm businesses and farm owners in the town, people who actually work the land, are very opposed to the zoning code. In particular, I talk about a man, Ken Miller. He was going to sell his land to Dollar General for a development. And the reason farmers there do this is it's kind of hard to operate smaller scale farms in America now, particularly the kind of hay and dairy business that used to predominate in Caroline. And so what you do in order to kind of keep your farmland that you oftentimes these people have had farms that go back, generations. I talked to one farming family who's owned their land since for the past 175 years. But the way that you keep this, you keep your land is you sell off some marginal bits of it for development or you start an RV park on part of your land that's, you know, maybe too hilly for farming or too rocky for farming. You experiment with different businesses that can make up for the loss of agricultural revenue. And all of that is threatened by zoning.
Yeah, it's a fascinating dynamic where you've got people saying, like, save the rural character of our land on one side, and then you've got the people who actually live in the rural parts of the town being like, no, please don't take away my right to do what I want with my land. We're talking with Christian Britschke. He's a reporter for Reason Magazine and the author of a piece you can find in the latest issue of the magazine. The Town Without Zoning is the name of the piece. It's about this fight going on in Caroline, New York over this zoning code. Christian, not a lot of time left here. This is something you write about a lot for us, is about zoning and kind of the way we should think about zoning, because it really is, it's a technical matter, but it really gets to kind of a core concern about property rights.
It's a question of, like, who knows best about the land that you own. You know, I visited some of these farms, and it's interesting, as someone sitting at the, City Hall, you can draw up a map saying, like, okay, this is farmland, we're going to keep it as preserved farmland. But then you go out and visit the farm, and you talk to the farmers, and they point out, like, oh, this land right here, it's not good for growing things. This land right here, it's flood, so we can't, plant anything there or drive equipment over there. But it might be good for this other use that we might want to try out or we haven't even anticipated yet. And that's just the kind of, like, local ingrained knowledge that you're not going to get from just a bureaucrat dividing up the map into different colored blocks. And so, yeah, just the idea that you know what's best for your land, your property, it's something that really gets missed with the kind of the hubris that's involved with trying to zone places.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. It's just like government, we think about like big government as meaning maybe the federal government or state government. Local governments can certainly be very oppressive too, and oppressive even in very small ways like this, just by saying, hey, you can't do what you want on your own land. Christian, really great piece. Thanks again for joining us here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And again, check that piece out. It's in the latest edition of Reason Magazine. It'll also be available later this month at Reason.com, or maybe early next month, I should say, I think at Reason.com, The Town Without Zoning by Christian Britschke. Head over there to check out everything else that we're working on as well. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It is called the Global Corporate Minimum Tax, and the United States should not be part of the compact. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The Treasury Department recently announced that it negotiated a delay to the imposition by foreign nations of the global corporate minimum tax. In 2021, the U.S. and 140 other countries signed on to an agreement under the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, that would implement a 15% minimum global corporate income tax in all partner nations. The deal had been cited by proponents, such as our own President Joe Biden and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, as an attempt to curb international corporate tax avoidance. However, the OECD global minimum tax agreement has several major negative policy implications that are being outright ignored in this discussion, including a decrease in economic competitiveness and tax competition, let alone the circumvention of the separation of powers laid out by the United States Constitution. Much of the argument for the global income tax is based on the premise that businesses need to pay their fair share. But proponents are forgetting the most important lesson when it comes to business taxes. Businesses don't pay taxes, people pay taxes. As former U.S. Senator Phil Gramm of Texas wrote in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year, quote, President Biden wants to make the world safer for tax increases, unquote. While some countries like Japan, South Korea, and those in the European Union have implemented the global minimum tax already, the United States wisely has not. Attempts to make those changes here have received bipartisan pushback in Congress, since American companies would be a major target in this global tax price-fixing scheme. Notably, U.S. Ways and Means Committee Chairman Jason Smith, an ALEC alumnus, has led the charge to oppose such an effort. The Biden administration is essentially holding Congress hostage by agreeing to allow foreign governments to collect taxes on American companies or their subsidiaries if the U.S. laws do not come into compliance with the deal. Sadly, it plays out for U.S. companies, and it looks like a case of heads you lose, tails you also lose. So what's the upside for the United States as the Biden administration attempts to unilaterally surrender U.S. sovereignty over its business tax policy? Well, that's a very good question, because a recent report from the Joint Committee on Taxation said that under one scenario, the United States would actually lose $122 billion in revenue as part of this deal. Beyond the major consequences for the United States, the ramifications of this global minimum tax deal could be disastrous for all countries that use pro-growth tax policy to expand their economies. Competitive tax rates encourage nations to craft smart policies or else lose out on the job creation and economic opportunity. The world can learn a lot about economic competitiveness by examining the dynamic of the 50 states in our system of competitive federalism. Letting the states establish their own tax rates and fiscal policy means that state leaders can determine what's best for their state economies. In many cases, competition with the other states forces leaders to implement policies to increase their economic competitiveness and growth. If the price to live, work, or start a business in one state becomes excessive through the cost of taxes and regulations, for instance, Americans can and often do vote with their feet in search of more economic opportunity. We see this in states across the country as Americans continue to vote with their feet away from high-tax states like New York and California and towards low-tax, freedom-loving states like Texas and Florida. Much like New York and California, we've witnessed the failure of burdensome, centralized tax structures on the international stage in the EU, where the average resident is poorer than the average resident of nearly every state in the United States. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that the Eurozone economy, with its high tax burdens and overregulation, grew only 7% over the last 15 years. Compare that with the 82% growth here in the United States. This is a tragic international example of how stifling economic competition turns out to be damaging for economic opportunity and growth. A global minimum tax regime prevents the very competition that has produced these great results through competitive federalism here in the United States. Just as the 50 states can and have competed on tax policy, so too should nations be striving to build better tax structures to build their economies through tax competition, not global command and control tax harmonization schemes. For more information, go to ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WEJZ-FM and WGNE-FM in Jacksonville, Florida, along with KSOK-AM in Arkansas City, Kansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program by visiting our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.